What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Many of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, which is my effort to find the most interesting people in the world and sit with them for hours while I ask questions in an effort to learn. So it would mean the world to me if you would subscribe to the show on your favorite audio platform, watch episodes on YouTube, and tell your friends and family about the podcast. My goal is to help millions learn from the world's most interesting people. So let's get into today's episode. Today's episode is a panel discussion from Bitcoin Investor Day, which was a conference I put together a couple of weeks ago in New York City for sophisticated Wall Street investors interested in Bitcoin. First up on the panel, we have Russell Starr. He's the head of capital markets at DeFi Technologies and their subsidiary Valor Asset Management. Next up, we have Zach Pandel. He is the managing director of research at Grayscale Investments. And lastly, we have Brett Tejpal, who's the head of Coinbase Institutional. This conversation was fantastic. We talk about a bunch of stuff, including fee structures for Bitcoin ETFs, institutional demand, business operations with price volatility, then the assets, Bitcoin, Ethereum, various altcoins, how the industry is still being driven by retail, and what regulation around the world looks like, how folks are thinking through asset selection, and what are each of these companies' product roadmaps. The conversation covers a ton. I learned a lot, and I think you will too. So I'm super excited for you to listen to this conversation with Russell, Zach, and Brett. Here it is now. Enjoy.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Today's episode is brought to you by Espresso, the maker of the world's thinnest portable display. Now listen up, if you're like me, you feel like you are at a command center when you sit down at your desk. I got a gazillion tabs open and different windows for different activities. There's my web browser, my text messages, I have Slack open, and I got a notes app. I normally work on a desktop and it can be very, very productive. But everything falls apart the second I leave my desk. If I'm traveling, if I go to a coffee shop to do some work, or just want to work from the kitchen table, my laptop doesn't have enough screen space. I lose my command center and my productivity falls off a cliff. It's a major problem. But this is where Espresso comes in. They have a portable screen that is so beautiful that you think Steve Jobs came back from the dead to create it. The thing is incredibly light, it comes with a nice stand, and the user interface is so easy that I figured it out. How to do it in less than 3 minutes. If you listen to this podcast, you know that's not an easy feat. So the Espresso team and I, we became friends. I got to know them because I really like the product. And those screens, they now want to offer them to any fan of the podcast. So we struck a little deal. Here's how it works. Anyone who listens to this podcast can go to us.espres.so. Or, that's too confusing, just go click the link in the description. If you go to Espresso's website, they've got a brand new offer there sitting for you. You get a little discount and you'll get a beautiful screen. Trust me, I use mine every day. You'll love the Espresso screen and I think it'll make you more productive. Go check them out today by clicking on the link in the description. This episode is brought to you by Bet Online. Do you like making a profit from sports betting? Well, set yourself up to take home the most profit possible using crypto to fund your sports betting, casino, and poker account at betonline.ag. You can avoid costly transaction fees, get your payouts lightning fast, and do it all securely and anonymously with the highest deposit and withdrawal limits in the industry. If you want to get in on the action, do it the smart way with crypto at betonline.ag. Head to the website, sign up with promo code POMP100 to get 100% bonus on your crypto deposit today. If you go and you deposit, they'll give you 100% bonus if you use promo code POMP100. Bet Online. The game starts here. BetOnline.ag. Go check them out today.
We've got Russell Starr, Zach Pandel, and Brett. Brett, how do I say your last name?
Tejpal.
There you go. I'm going to mess it up. My last name is Pompliano. No one ever gets it right. So I just give you the floor. I thought where we could start this conversation is, Russell, everyone has been talking about Bitcoin ETFs all day. DeFi and one of your subsidiaries, Valor, has the only Bitcoin ETFs, I think, in the world with a 0% management fee. So talk a little bit about kind of fee structures and why 0% management fee.
Sure. DeFi is kind of the Thomas the Tank Engine, the little guy that's still trying to get to be a teenager, maybe even an adult. We have two funds or two ETPs, ETFs, both which have zero management fees, our Ethereum zero and our Bitcoin zero. And our thought process was, look, we actually have permission to stake or lend all our underlying, which is something that in the US they don't have. So, you know, across DeFi, we sit with close to 700 million US, about a billion Canadian. We actually stake almost 90% of that and generate a ton of revenue for the parent company. By virtue of being able to lend the Bitcoin or, of course, stake the Ethereum, we can afford to charge zero management fees. Now, all of ours are listed in Europe, so it's a different dynamic than here in the US. But that's the nascent sort of background behind what happened and how we do it.
Got it. And maybe we can talk, Brett, in terms of Coinbase is one of the biggest custodians for these ETF providers. How do you all think internally of your different products and product lines? Maybe kind of explain a little bit as to the business itself on its face looks very much like a kind of Web2 company that's publicly traded and they're in the exchange business. There's a lot more when you look under the hood that you guys are doing. There's custody, there's obviously Base and some of the stuff. So maybe from your perspective, like how do you guys think of the products and how you guys are playing some in the traditional world, but also some in kind of this crypto native world?
That was like 19 questions packed into one. So super big picture. My comments really relate to the institutional side. That's what I'm responsible for at Coinbase. So the big picture there is we have three pillars. Pillar one is marketplaces. So everyone in this room hopefully understands and would recognize the U.S. spot marketplace that we run. But we have two more. We have the CFTC managed futures marketplace. And then over the past couple of months, we launched an international Bermudian perp exchange as well. And so that's the marketplaces. The central pillar is really the Prime platform. And that's the platform that pretty much everyone that's here, that's a high net worth client or an ETF client or other, would use that platform. That platform has custody embedded within it. And that's where you do everything you need to. So you can buy at the best price. We do smart order routing. You can sell, obviously, using the same tools. Most importantly, the bedrock is the custody, the safe custody of assets. But then with the curveball that we got from the SEC, which was around cash create, we also have a prime financing, you know, as this business in there. And so we're using Coinbase's balance sheet to actually do short-term lending, either crypto or cash, to facilitate trade use cases. And then, of course, you can also do seamless staking and lots of other things in that second pillar. And the third pillar for us is new. It's a bet on the asset management space. And so that's really in its earliest phases. And so that's the big picture on Coinbase. Specific to ETFs, I'm thrilled to be on stage with clients on both sides, and particularly with Grayscale, who I think this whole room owes a debt of gratitude to for all the things that they've done, and they've been with us, from the beginning. We're lucky at this moment in time to the Coinbase Prime, the custodial feature in particular, has won 8 out of the 10 U.S. ETFs that are out there. So on any given day, we custody about 90% of all the assets that exist for ETFs. I think we were named as 5 of 8 on the ETH, soon to be hopefully ETH. ETFs that are coming, but maybe just to finish up here, the big picture point is that coming from many years in institutional land, the institutions are definitely coming. And although you've talked about it a lot, your speakers have talked a lot about the significance of the green light that Kathy called it. This is really the big moment, and it doesn't really matter to me, day to day and net negative week on ETFs or not. In one fell swoop, we've activated 16,000 RIAs in the U.S. It's a really big deal. And then I think we'll hear from Zach in a minute, but the marketing engines have yet to really turn on. So if I had to guess, I would say they're probably only 10 to 15% turned on. And it takes a long time for RIAs to do their homework. You're not going to sell something. You have to understand what it is. You have to see if it's appropriate for your portfolio. So it takes time. And so I'm not sort of holding my breath day to day, week to week. I know that the super highway has been built, and we have enormous access to a combination of institutional retail flow coming.
Zach, your guys' fee came down, assets are going out. How are you guys thinking about it?
Well, thanks. Thanks, Brett. Thanks for having me. So for those of you who don't know, I think everybody's familiar with Grayscale, but Grayscale is the world's largest crypto asset manager with the largest Bitcoin fund, but also a whole suite of other products, a $10 billion Ethereum product, which we think will soon be an ETF, and a whole spectrum of other things, Solana, Chainlink. I did some of our Filecoin product myself yesterday. So a whole, you know, a large diversified crypto asset manager. And GBTC, of course, we're incredibly proud of what that has meant for the industry. You know, we came to the starting line on January 11th with 100% market share and $28 billion in assets, and never expected to maintain that that position, but are competing in a different way, you know, because of a different track record and a 10-year history and a large asset base to begin with. We think investors can expect the fee on the main fund to come down over time. And we also have filed now for a GBTC mini product. Some of you may have seen some press about this recently. If this is approved by the SEC, we would spin off a portion of the assets from GBTC into a smaller, lower fee product. And there's a lot of precedent for this in the ETF space already. There's a mini version of the GLD gold ETF, for example. So this is analogous to that that sort of product. So it's amazing to see the number of issuers in the Bitcoin ETF space. I think that that speaks to the breadth of support of the marketplace. I mean, hundreds of smart people did their homework on this asset class and decided to, you know, bet a portion of their business on it. And so, you know, we have competitors now in a way that we didn't in the past. The fee in the product will probably come down over time alongside this mini spinoff, and we'll continue to evolve the whole suite of products. All the other products we ultimately expect to be ETFs as well, hopefully with Ethereum coming up fairly soon.
So both for Zach and for Russell, maybe each of you could talk about the businesses that you all are in are quite interesting structurally because capital can flow in, capital can flow out, but also the price of the assets goes up. And so Grayscale, I don't know the exact numbers, but let's say it was $28 billion when the ETFs were approved. Although there has been outflows, the price of Bitcoin has gone up substantially. And so how do you both think about your businesses in terms of kind of asset price forecast versus, hey, we got to go out and do sales marketing, right? We got to get inflows as well if we want to drive more revenue.
Maybe I just answer that briefly first. So prior to Grayscale, I had a career on Wall Street as a macro analyst, most recently at Goldman. I made a very deliberate choice to abandon that career and go join Grayscale. And the reason is that I am incredibly bullish on this asset class. You know, I think our asset class will be many multiples its current size in the future. What's the right way to make that bet? You know, running an asset manager is a very straightforward way to make that bet. We benefit, exactly as you're saying, Pomp, from asset price appreciation. As the market cap gets better, gets larger over time, an asset manager is going to benefit from that. And these are very high operating leverage businesses. As the market gets bigger, we don't need, you know, more and more and more employees always to run those products. So asset managers tend to be attractive businesses for that. So this was a very deliberate decision of mine. I'm making exactly that bet. This is going to be a even much larger asset class in the future as it is today. And a business like Grayscale is incredibly well positioned to capture that opportunity.
Russell?
Yeah, we're in a little bit of a different basket than I would say Grayscale. Like I said, we're operating in Europe. We now have 17 ETPs. I think everyone here would be maybe shocked or interested in hearing this, but as exciting as Bitcoin and Ethereum are, the altcoin products to me are far more exciting. So we have a Uniswap product, Atom, Cardano, Polkadot, Solana. And ironically, we've never lost customers. Every single month, even with the sell-off, we had net inflows no matter what the market was doing. And I think that speaks to the resiliency of who is actually buying these products and the thought process that they have of, you know, where the future is. But what I find really, really fascinating, and I'm not sure what you guys have seen, out of the blue, our Solana product just started to go nuts. We now have the third largest Solana product in the world. And like I said, unlike many of the other products, we can actually stake it. So all of those assets are generating meaningful cash flow for our company. But the question I would posit to everyone here, and even you, Pomp, is, you know, is SEI the next one? Is, you know, who is the next Solana? And the beauty of the business that we're in, the Grayscale and DeFi business, you know, we're going to launch another 15 products this year, probably another 30 products next year. I suspect at some point someone's going to come knocking on our door just because we are the only one who basically stakes almost 100% of our assets, which is something different from the US. But where I think the really interesting data points are going to be is not necessarily the net inflows. It's going to be, you know, who is Solana number 2, 3, 4, 5? And that's something I don't know if people can even envisage or imagine, just because it's growing so quickly as an ecosystem.
Yeah, what's interesting, I guess, Bretton, and is related is everyone with the ETFs is very interested in the institutions, right? It's kind of the green light for the institutions. But I see people on Twitter or elsewhere talking about Google search volume's not back yet. You know, Coinbase was 500th app in the App Store, jumped up to 100. Oh, when it gets to number one, we're at the top, right? Kind of all these memes. And there's some truth to some of this stuff. But how much of it is pure institutions that they may be seeing in inflows or on Coinbase versus, no, like retail is coming back as well and looking to actually get exposure to these assets also?
I'd say that the... Well, the ETF welcomes a combination of institutional and retail as a starter. I would say those institutions that were early in the space and have been invested in the space mostly have accounts with us and it will own outright. So a good stat to remember would be if you look at, you know, Dan's world of the top 100 hedge funds in the world based on their assets under management. So literally the 100 biggest hedge funds in the world. A third of them are onboarded and active on our platform. And so they are looking at the ETF and saying, hey, that's great. It's another, you know, more liquidity. It'll attract more new capital to the space. My observation so far is it feels to me pretty still retail driven in the first phase. And so there's a lot of what I would call, you know, Mooch was talking about, you can call JP Morgan up and, you know, so there's a lot of self-directed retail that's opted into. If you're really, you know, if you've been into the space for a while, they probably owned Grayscale, you know, for a long period of time. So from my perspective, the ETF is additive. It still feels mostly retail driven for the moment. But there's another point that I wanted to make that kind of ties together what we were saying before. So I happen to have lived abroad and I've been in London for 12 years, and I've been running global businesses for 20 across fixed income, equities, commodities, emerging asset classes of all type. And one of the tougher decisions to actually get into the space was what is the regulatory posture in the U.S. and appetite, while rest of world was embracing things. And from the seat that I sit in, looking at the world's landscape and what's going on, never had a brighter moment than we've had now. The U.S. is finally catching up. You can't underestimate the significance of the SEC's approval for ETFs to happen. But there's like a tug of war going on. People want Coinbase in the Middle East. They want Coinbase everywhere. And it's a really fun moment in time because I feel a huge amount of momentum, whether it's looking at MiCA or I won't go into deep into regulatory stuff. But I can't think of a client segment, by the way. So you were talking before about central banks and sovereign wealth funds, et cetera. I can tell you sovereign wealth funds are definitely looking at the space and have been doing that for quite some time. But when I go through the institutional client segmentation, central banks, sovereign wealth fund, public corporates, private corporates, asset managers, hedge funds, high net worth networks, RIAs, you know, specialist asset managers, so on and so forth, there's not a segment, maybe with the exception of sovereign wealth funds, that has yet to really activate. So we have activation engagement up and down. And with this new advent, we have increased increased engagement. Last point on this is it takes a while. You know, I don't know if like Robbie was speaking before, but my first 4 years ago when I joined Coinbase, my first phone call was to BlackRock. Okay, it's 4 years later, and now they're here. So it takes a lot. If you're serious about the business of investing, if you're serious about the evaluation of operational risk, if you're serious about understanding regulatory affairs, et cetera, you got to go for, you know, do your work, right? And it takes a little bit of time. So just because we had a green light go doesn't translate at, like, instantaneously into institutional flow.
Zach, one of the things that's been interesting to me is passive investing has been so dominant in the equity market. It seems like in crypto, indexes haven't actually taken off nearly as much as single asset, you know, kind of funds. You all probably have some of the best data on this. Why is that? And why are people kind of more of almost stock pickers versus indexers when it comes to crypto so far?
Yeah, that's a great question. Some of it is, you could answer with Brett's comment, that it just takes time. You know, people have to do the analytical research and gather the data to build institutional grade index products. So we've been doing that. So at Grayscale, we have an effort that we call Grayscale Crypto Sectors, which is a rigorous taxonomy and framework to measure all of crypto with indexes in the same way that you would find in traditional finance. And we built that with FTSE Russell, the one of the big index providers in TradFi. So first we need to build the indexes, and then that process has basically just happened. I think the other part of it is that we're not quite ready, I think, to say that every asset is equally valid, despite having a high market cap. So, you know, investing in the top 50 assets or the top market cap weighted assets, you're probably going to get some things that you don't love in there. So I think partly we need to see the industry mature a little bit for pure passive management to make sense. I still think that there is a role today for research, for active management, for stock picking, as you put it, because not all of the assets in the top 50 or the top 100 have an equally promising future. I think we can all agree on that. So I think that's the direction that we're heading. I spend a lot of time on these index types of products, and I will plug our tool. If you want to learn about those things, please have a look at Grayscale Crypto Sectors on our website. It's a great way to understand how the different subsets of the market are performing. You know, it's well beyond Bitcoin and Ethereum, but you know, consumer and culture and web services and AI and all the different elements of the market, these tools can help you track those things in a consistent way.
Russ, you guys are vehicles in Europe. You live in Canada. You pay a lot of attention to the US market. What are some of the differences that you're seeing from investors in those three markets? And like, are there unique things in Europe that you all see that either one, you're trying to take advantage of, or two, people here in the US may be surprised by?
Yeah, there's quite a few. First and foremost, obviously, the regulatory environment in the US and Canada is very difficult. You know, we're not even... I should bring back our 2 years ago. We were actually permitted. We had the NASDAQ approval. We had our DTC, and then the SEC intervened and literally ragged the puck, to use a coffee or a hockey euphemism, ragged the puck for almost 8 months. And we just had to walk away. In Europe, they're extremely pro-crypto. I think a lot of that is probably due to one of our co-founders is here. His name is Johan Wattenstrom. He's the one of the founders and creators of XBT Provider and CoinShares. I think they paved the way specifically in Scandinavia, where most of our products are listed. They're on Euronext as well, but the Scandinavian culture or trading mentality has just been epic. Like I think there was a day or a week where we did almost as much in trade flow in that week as we did the previous year. And I think it's more just educating the process. I think once the SEC maybe truly backs off and allows for free thinking and you know, a company such as ours to list on the NASDAQ, I think that those will be big bellwethers. But the other thing that, you know, I watch and I see, and I think back to what Dan was saying in his comment, you know, there are new companies that are emerging. And you know, we're one of those interesting ones that has our business and operations in Europe, but our listing here in Canada. You know, we all got to support these new companies and these businesses. Everybody needs to get together and recognize that, you know, TradFi has a really meaningful position to bring to disseminating this decentralized system to, you know, the mom and pops. You know, so that's probably a long-winded way of saying, you know, Europe is pro-crypto. Germany basically gives you a tax break if you hold your crypto investments for a year. I'd really love to see the US get to a position where they're actually embracing this ecosystem. I mean, if you think about what the US is and what it's been, you know, why isn't Galaxy allowed to list on the NASDAQ? I mean, that's perplexing to me. It just, you know, let's all get together, support this industry, move it forward. It's clearly the future. And let's embrace it the way, you know, Europe is, the Middle East is, and Asia is.
That makes sense. And Brett, one of the things that I think you guys have really kind of figured out is regulation is huge headwind. But also it seems like just through reading Twitter and many of the employees at Coinbase, you all will take turns sometimes, hey, whatever regulators say, let's do it. Other times kind of push back and take a stand where you guys think are correct. How does that affect the institution conversation? And what I mean by that is, on one hand, Coinbase is you know, the most regulated American-based exchange. And I think that you guys get tons of credit, right, for kind of having that long history of execution and operation and kind of trust, frankly. On the other hand, I could see institutions sometimes being like, oh, well, the regulators are scrutinizing you, especially for like young companies. That's a huge concern in the space. And so like, what in the conversations with institutions as you guys are building products or trying to serve them, do they care so much about the regulatory treatment you guys get, or is being a public company enough to kind of, hey, we're good to keep using you because of that track record and the public status?
So quick reflection, when I was evaluating, you know, what I thought was going to be the next big thing, and I was thinking about how to pair that up with which company, there was only, like, for me, there was a choice of one, which was Coinbase, because Brian had opted in the beginning to decide to build the entire platform from a regulated standpoint. I came in to build the institutional business, having been 27 years in regulated finance, and I know how to do that. And so we built everything from the very, very beginning with, at least from my perspective, with a view that my life at Coinbase, if successful, in many ways was going to have elements of my life in TradFi, where I'd fly around the world and meet with all sorts of different regulators. I was compliant in all the places that we were operating in, and we'd have a, you know, robust pushback and pull and what makes sense and what doesn't. And, but we would always pass our audits and, you know, all that. And so I also had the responsibility of actually hiring everyone in the business. And so we hired people who are known by the regulators, so on and so forth. So there's not really that much, I would say, dissonance with respect to building things that are compliant. I think, you know, Brian will tell you, and this is really more his place to comment than mine, but we'll push back when it doesn't make sense. And so I think as the institutional clients sort of saw things play out, this whole space had a real unfortunate sort of mishap, the world's largest fraud with FTX, right? And I told you before that institutions take many years before they actually deploy the first dollar of capital. And so yeah, that sort of took the giant fraud, but it was fraud. It wasn't because the thesis around what this is and what value it represents and its transformational layer of financial services was going to go away in that moment. And so one of the most notable things that happened were both, you know, the Grayscale lawsuit with the SEC and then everyone's decisions to file for a Bitcoin ETF. After that, the market hadn't healed yet. And so I think that is probably the biggest sign we'll ever see of institutions having embraced and have institutional conviction and fortitude to push forth, you know, in a place where the lead regulator was really saying, no, then I don't want to. And so this moment is, again, you can't underestimate how important it is in terms of the inspiration and the catalyst for others. I mean, people are looking at Grayscale as an early adopter, but Larry Fink and BlackRock and seems to have changed their tune. They have a pretty progressive view of what the transformational nature of crypto is going to be on financial services. You can't really afford to ignore that. And so it's a really awesome time to be here.
How do you guys think about asset selection for different vehicles that you create? So we talked about indexing, but now Russ and the folks at DeFi, right? I think that they have a very explicit strategy of don't try to go compete on Bitcoin and Ethereum in the United States, go to Europe, go long tail. Grayscale seems to be kind of in the middle, right? You do have Bitcoin and Ethereum. You're kind of trying to fight those competitive battles. But at the same time, it seems like you guys are starting to push a little bit further kind of down into the, you know, coin market cap ranking or whatever. Like, how do you think about which assets to go to and which ones not?
Well, we're in service of our clients. So we're trying to make products that investors are excited about and that we think will deliver them healthy returns over time. So of course, Bitcoin and Ethereum are a huge part of our marketplace. You know, this is a very lopsided marketplace in some ways, where so much market cap is just on these one and two assets. But we're always thinking about what is the sort of next generation of product. A good recent example is staking. Russ mentioned this a little bit. In the US, it's very difficult to stake. It's difficult for institutions and individuals to stake. We recently launched a first active vehicle. It's primarily staked alt coins. That's an actively managed portfolio of alts designed to generate staking income. So this is the type of sort of new product that investors are interested in today. Investors that are more sophisticated about crypto, they already have Bitcoin, maybe through the ETF, maybe through something else. They may already have Ethereum, and they're looking for more exposure, for potentially higher returns. And that's where the kind of the marginal product design debates are. And staking would be a good example of something that is out recently.
Russ, when you guys are building these products, you have to go through deciding who to custody with. There's a bunch of other service providers, auditors, et cetera, that you have to go through. Coinbase, is talking about how they've won most of these. What does that process look like for you guys? And how much of it is we're trying to, save money and kind of get the best, deal versus you don't want to mess around in finance and just go with kind of the name brand, kind of highest trust vendors?
So I can happily say we definitely do use Coinbase. So that's a good thing.
because if not, Brett was going to track you down afterwards and be like, sign up. All right, go ahead.
First of all, we generally cycle between the top four, five, or six custodians. So, FIDO, Anchorage, Coinbase, we're smart, we're sensible. Johan's history and tenure in this industry with XBT Provider, I wouldn't be surprised if our risk management system is not all that dissimilar to CoinShares. But it is, to a large extent, a very risk-averse perspective, given that you've seen so many black swan events. But the other thing I would add is, because we have the luxury of actually being able to stake our underlying, we don't have to custody a ton of our assets. So, if we're putting 100%, like our Solana product's now 350 million US, and we can earn almost 10% on that right now, we put that right back into the Solana chain, and we don't necessarily need to custody it. So it really depends on our total AUM. As our AUM grows, we can obviously stake a higher percentage of the AUM because you're protected against a black swan event. And then it really comes down to definitely some costs, obviously, but most of the top providers are very, very competitive and reasonable, and they also are helpful and listen to their customers, which is something that's fantastic.
Here's a stat for you, just so you understand what institutional due diligence actually feels like. So I actually have an entire team. Okay, so it's 12 people. The only thing they do is answer due diligence questions in RFPs. That's the only thing they do. Okay, 40% of the questions are about security and operational protocols, but we have a couple clients who have accrued, because we keep track of everything that's asked, over 1,000 questions. Okay, 1,000 questions. Can you think about 1,000 questions and how long it takes to come up with 1,000 questions? And that's what we had to answer in a satisfactory manner. We had to test things front, back, left, right. What if, what if, what if? How does it work? 1,000 questions. So I have like a small factory that just tries to keep up with the pace of making sure. Now, that happened at the same time that FTX happened. Can you believe that? I couldn't be more disappointed in some of the clients that I knew who personally invested in the platform. I said, you should resign from your job, tell everyone that you lost money and you can't manage other people's money anymore. But we're beyond it now. But those questions have kept coming and coming and coming. So as a leading indicator of institutional deployment of capital is an assessment on, I think, where we are in that factory. How busy is my factory of answering questions? And I can tell you it's pretty darn busy.
If you have an AI startup, Brett sounds like a great person to to be a customer. Talk a little bit about the institutional kind of product roadmap and what some of the customers want that you guys either haven't built yet or you're in the process of building.
Yeah. So going back to just like a then and now, when I joined Coinbase, we had like one thing, which is custody. We still have that one thing. It is the central value proposition of what we do. Okay. Safe custody. We're in our sixth generation now. But when I was building the vision for Brian to say, hey, this is what I think this space can become. It actually looks a little bit, for those of you that are, it's okay in this point to reference TradFi or that world. But I said we could have derivatives and structured products and index and financing. And, you know, if people are going to become comfortable with this asset, it has to feel like if you're going to manage other people's money, you need to do it in a familiar way, right? You need to respond to auditors and audit reports and accountants and lawyers and legal and everything else. But the clients want to have the full set of things that they're used to having when they manage anything actively. So a spot market, a derivative market, you know, and then crypto has some really cool stuff that the old world doesn't have, right? Which is amazing, like staking. I mean, the PERP product by itself is the coolest innovation in derivatives that I've been doing derivatives for nearly 30 years now. Okay, that is an awesome product. I'm not allowed to market it on US, so that wasn't marketing. It was just an observation. But we want clients to be able to do everything. Now, crypto is hugely capital inefficient as well. If anyone knows, you know, my early clients used to call them and say like, hey, buy me, you know, 10 bucks of Bitcoin. I'm like, that's not how it works, man. You actually need to wire the money first. And he's like, no, I'm good for it. I mean, I'm like, all right, we'll figure this out. So clients need capital efficiency across different things. So a long over here, a short over there, longest spot position, portfolio margin. I'm going to throw some technical terms, but they need advanced ability to be able to do position recognition, valuation, netting, so on and so forth. So plus all the crypto native things. And so delivering that whole landscape is a big challenge, which is why we have so much of our firm constantly delivering new products.
Makes a ton of sense. Zach, maybe we'll finish up with you. When you think of the Grayscale business moving forward, you mentioned indexing, some active management funds, et cetera. Are there things that you all are looking to either develop or customers are asking for that you guys don't yet offer?
I can't get into all the products that may be coming down the pipe, but I can assure you that we are laser focused on every trend that is happening all the way down the altcoin stack. And there are a lot of things that people are excited about today, whether it's interoperability or AI or any of the themes that all of you are excited about. So those products are coming down the pipe. Given the regulatory structure in the U.S., the way that Grayscale is set up is that these things start as private placement type of products or private funds, and I think that'll be the case for the time being until the regulatory status is sorted out. So that will be the product structure. But in terms of token type, we already have a wide range of things available, and you'll see more of that coming over time. And I could just say one other thing. You know, I think the Ethereum product, deserves a look. This thing still trades at a discount to NAV. Speaking for myself, I think approval is going to happen. And I think that'll be a very big deal for that asset. So if I had to kind of feature one of the Grayscale product suite to this group today, I think the ETHI product looks very attractive. That's the one that I'm most actively recommending to our clients at the moment.
Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it. You guys are all building great businesses and excited to see what you guys do throughout this bull market.
Thanks, Pomp.